Chapter 13, Cracking Yolks. Professor Barrow is certainly special, summarized Sean as they walked down the long, deserted corridors towards Newton's Digs and Cambridge University's Trinity College.
Yes, we may have modern anatomy, but we still have the human humours to contend with.
Isaac, you can measure the effects of gravity, but do you have a guess as to what causes it?
I do not feign hypotheses, replied Newton haughtily.
What does that mean?
It means your guess is as good as mine. My rule is, if in doubt, factor it out.
Then publish it?
Newton looked dismayed.
You mean tell other people?
Well, yes, replied Sean.
Never.
Why not?
What if they steal it?
If you publish first, they can't.
Newton patted the pocket containing the watch.
Too risky. Better just keep it to myself.
But you're Isaac Newton. You write the laws.
You betcha. Newton's laws will hold forever.
But if you don't publish how you derived them, the truth will never come out.
There's never been much of a market for the truth. Anyway, today's dawning of truth is this afternoon's firelighter. Just ask Giordano Bruno. Put everything he had at stake. The world of natural philosophy is a jungle, believe me.
So how are your laws of motion going?
They started well, but now I've hit a problem. Aristotle had several hundreds of explanations for why things move as they do, and more on the drawing tablets when he died. Try as I might, I can only come up with three. They stopped at a door, from behind which some grunts were emanating. The university boxing club here is an early adopter. They are testing them out for me. Sean sneaked a look inside. A few die-easies were standing punching each other in the face in the name of sport. On the wall was emblazoned the earliest known edition of Newton's laws of motion.
1. If a body be laid to rest, it doth stay at rest.
2. The harder thou hittest, the harder they fall.
3.
Thou gettest back what thou givest out.
Followed by the warning, break all three and out be thee.
So, how can you establish yourself in the universal laws of nature market if you can't publish? Asked Sean.
With a deadly form of patience, all my own.
When I'm ready, the sacks are going to move in on the London maths cartels, in particular the Royal Society, the socks. It will be nasty, they fight with hooks, but one day the socks will belong to me. Our motto will be nullius in verba, meaning don't take the word of no one. Cash up front in return for the right equations. Believe me, I'll have all of Europe screaming for British stuff. That's why I keep it secret for now. In anagrams, not publishing, to control the street price, you see.
So, one day the whole world will know about Newton's laws of motion?
Only if they buy a renewable license. I write the law. In this world, nothing moves without my say-so.
Newton's laboratory was in his private digs, although the word excavation would have been more helpful for initial orientation. It was cramped, and rather not what one would expect to be the venue of some of the most important scientific discoveries ever. The bookcases were filled with over 100 books, most of which were occult and alchemical references. There was a staggering range of glass instruments and tools, and two stoves, one of tin and one of iron. When Newton was satisfied with the temperature of a copper crucible on the oven, he carefully pulled out the folded handkerchief containing the eggshells left by Jenny and Pow.
These are encapsulations of the elixir of eternal youth.
Really? Replied Sean. Leonardo called them tempus albumen. I figure they appear in the crust of our planet due to some force that is compressing time, squishing it all up, putting it under pressure. So, like lava bursting out of a volcano, they are forced to the surface.
Like I said, the elixir of eternal youth, nodded Newton.
Allow me to digress. I've made a long and detailed study of ancient tourist sites.
Newton pulled down a large multifolio from a shelf.
I'm sure that King Solomon's great temple was designed to be a giant machine.
A machine that does what?
A machine that could rise through the ages of time and be one with a cosmic background.
Newton found the page he was looking for and held it up. Sean saw it contained some extremely detailed drawings of King Solomon's temple, and was accompanied by many scrawling mathematical calculations, giving the whole thing a rather pleasing crackular effect. Newton shook his head, but Solomon's temple failed to rise. Why? Not enough eggs. Does it help you if I tell you that Solomon decreed his temple be built entirely from a rare and precious stone imported from Egypt, known then as now as the One Stone, a stone that came from only one quarry and is a form of pink porphyry? Ah, began Sean, and he got his geometry wrong. The Egyptians did a little better with the pyramid shape. I see. Both Solomon and the Egyptians used the very same stone within which are found these time eggs, the very same pink porphyry that the Romans invaded Egypt in search of, that the emperors forbade anyone else to use and called imperial porphyry, or more commonly, the emperor's little pinky. This was the famed One Stone that the philosopher trade is still dependent on, and the source of the stone has been lost. The Crusaders tried for 100 years to re-find it, but could not. I am convinced that the source cannot be found simply because it is no longer there, at least not in the Middle East. You mean it has moved? Yes. After more than 1,000 years of scarcity, the eggs seem to be reappearing. According to the New Alchemist's Quarterly, the source of the pink stone has crossed to Europe. There is a non-ecclesiastical organization which is dedicated to finding it. They call themselves Sectatori Rosei Crociati, the Seekers of the Pink Crossing. The Rosicrucians, gasped Sean. While Newton prepared a second crucible with a concoction of smelly unctions and powders, Saki, do you know what Solomon and the Egyptians were trying to do by building these enormous egg boxes? Yes. Having studied the ancient geometers, Euclid, Archimedes, and Vitruvius, I can definitely say find a particular orientation of the eggs. In fact, they were trying to create a giant crystal which could orientate itself on the timeless cosmic background. Sean thought of Nono and his explanation of the Spen mat, his theory of the space-energy-matter background, where time does not exist, was reset to zero for another go, as Nono once put it. In fact, they were trying to create a giant crystal which could orientate itself on the timeless cosmic background. Euclid gave Archimedes his great work, The Elements, including illustrations of the golden ratio, to pin up in his maths factory to keep his workers happy. And it was Archimedes who passed the principles of two- and three-dimensional erotic geometry to the Roman architect Vitruvius. From his designs was built a structure which is a giant sphere within a cylinder. It looks uncannily like a ball for foot. The Romans built a rhombi? Exclaimed Sean. I mean, a rhombicuboctahedron? Try to, at any rate. It is called the Pantheon, a place to talk to all the gods at discounted group rates. A cosmic blog? Asked Sean. But I've been in the Pantheon. I experienced nothing special. The eggs were removed and sold as invasion souvenirs to the invading Visigoths. It never worked anyway. The Romans, being Italian, went for the look rather than occult functionality. In any case, they did not possess the mathematics. To build a true Vitruvian crystal, you need the power of Spiki Celesti, and all traces of that had been destroyed in Syracuse 200 years earlier. The church tried too, but got all their tolerances crossed. Orthodox churches got the basic shape better, but by then there were no more eggs to be found, just a few smoky imitation ones they waved around during ceremonies for special effects and to cut down on the mosquitoes. And what would happen if such a crystal were built? Asked Sean. The original project specifications have it that whomsoever enters the Vitruvian crystal would never age, for time would become meaningless, and that must mean that they would be able to be anywhere in time. Take your friends, for example. You mean the time riders don't jump time? They are already in all moments of time simultaneously. The only thing I don't understand is why they, and you, can do this with a single egg, and yet, except for some jumbled visions of the future, the eggs have no effect on normal people. Oracles and alchemists have been trying, and failing, for thousands of years to unlock the secrets of the omelet of eternal youth. So, went on Sean, that is why Jenny and Pau always talk about cycling through the timeline. For them, it is a never-ending loop, when in reality, they are everywhere and always. Sean went through his meetings with the Time Riders in his mind, recalling their sense of detachment. He shook his head. Except Jenny. She cared. Newton was busy taking well-used vials and instruments from shelves and hunting through drawers. Every when or no when. If time does not exist for them, what they are experiencing when they manifest in a specific time is an illusion. They just agree to go along with it for a while. They are not really there in the sense you and I understand. Not really alive, Sean quoted Chespulio, not for the first time, bitterly. Lacking an anchor in time, what they think are their memories are simply little stories they tell themselves to explain something they otherwise cannot understand. Without a memory of time past, Sean Saulpierre, you cannot conceive a future, and without a future, existence is pointless. And me? Asked Sean, suddenly very afraid. Am I really here? Am I experiencing an illusion too? No, there is something different about you. You are neither fully a time rider nor fully ordinary. Both here and not here, said or maybe thought Sean, remembering now, for some reason, Schrody, the half-dead cat. Newton was starting to experiment, preparing one concoction after another. While they waited for the sweat of Hermes to come to the boil, Sean asked the question that had been lying in lurk the whole day. Saki, why is Chespulio hunting us? You and the watch are inexplicably linked. That makes you a marker for Chespulio. Find Sean Saulpierre and he finds the watch. And the time riders, are they drawn to the watch too? Yes. At least, they seem drawn to events in history in which the Spici Celesti, the language of the gods, makes a leap forward. What your and their ultimate purpose is, I cannot say. But I do know it is important enough for an entire race of strange creatures from a distant future time to come over the gap that separates our two worlds, to form a demonic alliance with Chespulio, to hunt down you and the Sangreal. For this reason, and to honour Archimedes, Leonardo, and Galileo, I will help you, for they believed in you and your mission too. But Saki, what is this it I'm supposed to do? I think you must seek your grandfather, Nonno. And when you find him, I think you will also find your mother. Are they together? Sean had not felt so much hope since the day he had started his incredible journey. Newton placed a kind hand on his shoulder. I regret I cannot say for sure, but I sense the presence of your Nonno when I am near the watch. Others have said the same thing. Why can't I sense him? For the subsequent while, Newton gave Sean a crash apprenticeship in the mysticized world of alchemy. Half chemistry and half voodoo, it at times seemed to suggest a rational method, then at crucial moments veered off into the realm of superstition and fanatical beliefs rooted securely in the vaporous air it produced by the roomful. I've never had so much eggshell at one time, explained Newton, obviously quite excited. My suppliers, who import from a Swiss distributor, bring me the occasional fragment, more often than not mixed with worthless powder. None of us, the great Robert Boyle included, have ever seen a full shell, never mind an egg that contains Tempus albumen, time juice. Boyle, like Barrow after him, scoured Europe, visited the home of Galileo, all the known sites of cracking of the yolks. Either he was missing the essential sense of the humours, or else the yolks were too old, but not once did these bring him to smile. And you, which method do you follow? I used to use Descartes to read the future. Now I bring the unctions to the Boyle. Newton pointed at Robert Boyle's collected works on chemical magic. Newton now took a large notebook and began writing in it in a strange, perpendicular and almost microscopic handwriting. I have recorded everything I have seen during my long, lonely vigils over the alchemist furnace, roasting the eggshells in search of the materia prima. Newton now poured some mercury into a bowl. Tell me, what does your age know of mercury? It is the only liquid metal, so it is obviously the fundamental of all metals. The Greeks called it hydrargyrum, which means watery silver. In fact, its chemical symbol is still Hg. Sean wrote it down for him. Hig? And the search for the Hig fundamental, does it continue? You could say that, yes. In my day, the world's largest governments unite their resources to build the most expensive and powerful machines ever constructed, to try to reveal the secret of the fundamental particles, especially one they called the Higgs particle. Ah, alchemy is recognized at long last. Newton swirled the liquid metal in the bowl. See how formless and how brilliantly silver mercury is? That is because it has no light inside it. When it doth combine with light, it formeth all other metals and gives them their form. So it is with eggs and time. Only when the time liquid mixes with matter does the perceived world take form. Sean looked at the dish. He saw a white crystalline star shape, with shards radiating from, or equally towards, a singular core. It's beautiful. It is the star Regulus of antimony. See how a small concentration of the antimony in crystal form draws all similar metal powder irresistibly to it. So I ask, what if a large crystal of the time eggs were formed? Would it draw all time towards it in just such a way? The ancient Greek, actually he wasn't all that old, Democritus, known as the little nitpicker by his school chums, imagined all things in the world being composed of tiny parts called atoms. Could it be that, rather than being a smooth, continuous liquid, time is also composed of very small chunks, the smallest of which are indivisible? Sean nodded. We call them chronons. And like all metals, these can be isolated, distilled, and reassembled in a different form. That, I believe, is the nature of the eggs. For when your friends did disappear, they did so in a mercurial storm. That is the fundamental of the universe. The milk that formed the whole galaxy. Galaxos ubiquitos. You see, galaxos is Greek for milk. Divine providence is allowed to flow when we crack open an egg. It is purified liquid providence, and our portal to the cosmic background, the spenmat, as you say your nonno calls it. With this we can cause the fundament of the soul, the anima, to decant, as has happened to your friends. Contributed Sean. Newton lit some more coke with a taper from the fire, and prepared his alembic for distilling liquids. Now we apply the technique of Helvetius. Please read the recipe. Newton gave Sean a chemically stained, and in places charred, volume, bookmarked to a page by Swiss Oculist Supplies Emporium flyer. Disanimaeum, the decantation of the anima via the philosopher's stone, he read. Ingredients, take a fresh piece of brimstone. Newton placed a soft piece of yellow chalk-like substance in a copper bowl on the iron oven. Distillatum in solemnis extractium tribicos. Newton carried out the distillation and poured the residue through a funnel into another receptacle. Then, in accordance to the instructions as Sean read them, Newton very carefully measured amounts of sometimes quite smelly powder, metal, and suspicious-looking liquids, and heated them to various degrees and lengths. The more pungent, the better it seemed to please him. Then Sean read the final lines, which made even less sense to him. What is all this? He asked, looking up. Oh, it is always the last ingredient, a carefully calculated amount of distilled mumbo-jumbo, read only by one who is pure spirit and soul, so go ahead. But you're a scientist, not a magician. That's why I distill it, agreed. Tell me, where do these recipes come from? It is usually assumed that this knowledge dates back to the time of the Old Testament. But, according to Professor Barrow, the handwriting of John the Measurer found in Constantinople supposedly matches the basalt hand chiseling in Alexandria, where they originate. I see, said Sean, who didn't really, but thought he had done for a brief moment. He looked at the brutish concoction as it bubbled, toiled, and troubled away on the fire. So what are we trying to do exactly? As we all know, the world is composed of four elements. Fire, earth, water, and I always forget one. Air? That's it. Thank you. I see you are a trained chemist. Obviously, to transmute a substance, we need simply adjust the proportions of these four elements in it. Simple and logical, you must agree. You'll get the hang of it. Now, these eggshells are clearly more earth, but they showed fire to release the swirl which engulfed your friends when they disappeared into eternal time. The swirl was clearly primarily of the element water. Follow me? Hence, to reactivate the eggs, we need only to replace the lost fire and add a little fluidity. Water? Are you mad? Pure essence and transmutation? No,
We must reduce the level of magic by using a Lester oil. It is an oil that lessens transmutation to safe levels. Many alchemists failed because they did not use it. Boyle summed it up in his book, Lest We Forget. My own concoction, a combination of two such Lesters, I call Co-Lester.
He duly placed the eggshells in a fresh copper bowl on the low flame, before gingerly adding equal amounts of their animaeum concoction and the oil. The pieces of eggshell floated to the surface, quite indifferently, quite all they were cracked up to be. The two experimenters bent closer over them and watched as they eventually sank and bubbled, and began to give off a vapour.
"Empty eggshells are no yolking matter," Newton began to say.
"Sean?"
The young man who was standing next to Newton looked very confused at his present situation, and said so in unwavering pre-Edrop dialect.
"Oh dear," said Newton, as he wrote in his notebook with a scrawly, microscopic handwriting, "too much cholesterol oil in these eggs."